and 8.8 back to their play has struck chill.
Eden Humanities, right? Room 150, is that right?
Yeah.
Eden Humanities, room 150 at 7 p.m. This is the 4x4 reading series, which is something that we do in conjunction with CSU, Naropa, and DU, where students in the various writing programs collectively do a reading. So that'll be tonight on campus. Tomorrow night, our esteemed guest is going to be reading at DU at Sturm Hall, room 381 at 7:30 p.m. And Saturday night, the literary journal and group, The Umbrella Factory, is putting on an event, J. Michael Martinez, Julie Carr, and Matthias Felina. That's going to be in Denver at the Fluid Coffee Bar on 19th and Pennsylvania. So attend those, lots of other great stuff going on. I'm just going to say a few words about our guest. So Amiri Bracco was born in Newark, New Jersey. After leaving Howard University in the Air Force, he moved to the Lower East Side of Manhattan in 1957. He published his first volume of poetry, prefaced to a 20-volume suicide note, in 1961. This was followed by over 40 books of essays, poems, drama, and music history and criticism, which established him as a poet icon and revolutionary political activist. Bracco is renowned as the founder of the Black Arts Movement in Harlem in the 1960s, and has been the subject of numerous documentary films, including Mario Van Peebles' Poetic License for the Sundance Channel. Additionally, he's appeared in dozens of films on television, infamously holding his own against Bill O'Reilly. Bracco's numerous literary honors include fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts, the Penn Faulkner Award, the Rockefeller Foundation Award for Drama, the Langston Hughes Award from the City College of New York, and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Before Columbus Foundation. He was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters in 1995. In 1994, he retired from the State University of New York in Stony Brook, and in 2001 was named Poet Laureate of New Jersey, and we can talk about that later on, and Newark Public Schools. In 2007, his award-winning one-act play, Dutchman, was revived at the new Cherry Lane Theater in New York and received critical acclaim and international attention. His book of short stories, Tales of the Out and Gone, was published in late 2007. Home, his book of social essays, was re-released in early 2009. The University of California Press recently published Digging, the Afro-American Soul of Classical American Music, a brilliant assemblage of his writings on music, which blends autobiography, history, musical analysis, and political commentary. And his previous essay collection, The Essence of Reparations, explored the interrelated issues of racism, national oppression, colonialism, neocolonialism, self-determination, and national and human liberation. It has been said that he is committed to social justice like no other American writer. Some 40 years ago, Bracco told the world that poems are bullshit unless they are teeth or trees or lemons piled on a step. He called us on our bullshit, on the bullshit of America's racism, the bullshit of poverty, property, prosperity, and propaganda. It's a call that continues to echo, to sound and resound, reshaping not only the literary landscape, but far more importantly, the worldliness, dailiness, the living, the political, social, and cultural life from which our literature emanates. So it's my pleasure to introduce Amiri Bracco. We're going to be pretty low-key and informal here, and essentially this is a question-and-answer session. And at any point you have a question, you know, feel free to call it out. I thought I would maybe get us going. I'm just curious, as someone who's like not only performed and written in and been completely immersed in every sort of genre possible, I'm curious about when you go to write, when you sit down to write something, do you decide beforehand, this is going to be a play, this is going to be an essay? How does that work for you?
Well, if you're fortunate, you can decide that. Well, usually, you just go. You know, Franco Harris said, when you're running a race, you don't say, give it up. I won the race last year. You just go on nerve. And that's what it is. You go on your nerve. You just do whatever it is You know, I mean, there was a story I always like to tell that I heard from somebody who I can't give credit to. He told me, he said, Billy the Kid and his nephew were walking down the street one day, and they go past this field of reeds, and the nephew says, Billy, make me a whistle. And he says, pow, and he shoots a hole in it. And the nephew says, well, how did you do that without aiming? He said, I'm always aiming. So that's the story about the writer. You're always aiming. You're always, whatever you see or feel or look at is going to come out. And you know it's going to come out one day. You might write it down. You might not write it down. Writing it down is a good idea. I know the best poets I know always, you know, when they go in their pocket, man, they're bringing out their notebook. But no, it's a question of study, you know, because you can't write without studying. I mean, these people think you just write off the top of your head are boring, usually, you know. You have to do a lot of studying, try to find out what's happening in the world. You know, Richard Wright said, you have to be the top of your time. Top of your time. Whatever's happening in the world that you're in, you should know about it. You know, what's the best drama in the world? You know, what's the best music? What's the most moving painting? You know, what's the, you know, whatever. Who's the best boxer in the world? Whatever's happening in the world, that's what you should do. You should find out what the best is. What's the most moving? What's the most profound? You see. Because that's where you want to be. When you do what you're doing, you want to be there. I mean, you don't want to be coming in writing some stuff somebody wrote and was boring 20 years ago. You know what I mean? At least be your original borer. You know what I mean? So it's a question of study. It's a lot of study. You know, I was telling my man there, a lot of people think of Allen Ginsberg, for instance, as just, you know, blah, 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 blah. But Allen was a scholar, see. That's what you don't know. It's impossible to, bam, without that always aiming thing. You know, that's the question. It's the preparation. The preparation. What is the preparation? Study. Study the world. Study books. Study painting. Study music. Study. And if you're really interested in being that too, then you'll love to do that. You know, you love to do research on anything, you know. One thing, when I got kicked out of college, this is not urging you to do that, but when I got kicked out of college and I went into the Air Force, I was embarrassed to tell my parents, you know, I got kicked out. So I went in the Air Force. And I spent like 10 and 12 hours a day reading. Why? Because you're sitting there guarding an airplane. The only thing you had to learn to hide the book as the APs came around, you know, you're not supposed to be. But one thing that happened is that I became addicted to reading. I mean, in a way that it's not just you love to read, it's that you must read. See, that's another level of it. It's not you love reading, you must read. I start reading paper on the ground, you know, if it's lying there long enough. You know. But that idea of study is the most important aspect of writing to me, you know. And study takes a lot of forms. I'm not just talking about books. I'm talking about anything that you need to know about, that you don't know about wholly, you know. Not the surface of things, you know. Anything that goes on, you wonder, why does it do that? Why does it look like that? Why does it smell like that? Why do they talk like that? That's what, so that the important writers, and you might think some are more important than I do or less important, but they always are telling you something that you didn't know before. You know, it's impossible to be the great writer without having a dictionary somewhere around, because you know them words that you don't know them words. You know, I mean, I was reading Melville last month for the first time since I was a wee lad, and I kept saying, where's my dictionary? Where's my dictionary? Because, why? Because he studied some stuff that I hadn't studied. You know, I didn't know the history of whaling. I mean, that's what that is. That's a whaling textbook. It's not just a novel about going out killing a whale. that's a whole history of the industry of whaling. You understand the history of the people in whaling. You know, so writing a book, and it's pitiful now, the context that you grow up in, because for instance, the New York Times bestseller list is like garbage. You know, man, it didn't used to be quite as much garbage. It was always garbagey, but it was never. It was never all the way garbage. You know. In fact, I became the night librarian when I was in the Air Force. I was the night librarian. This woman, she was a young white woman. She worked in this thing where they give you uniforms to travel around, to be in different social services. And she found out that I not only liked to be in the library, but I knew what I was doing. That's the last time I saw her. She gave me the key. Call me if you need me at this number. She was in Puerto Rico somewhere. But the point is, I became the night librarian, and the people with me, five or six dudes, all young men who found themselves in the Air Force without wanting to be in there, who later thought themselves as intellectuals who were just starting to read. That's what we did every night. We'd go in there, we'd get some vodka and some rum. I don't know if you do that when you do your study. But that's what we would do. We would, and the best kind of learning is discussion. It's not just booking, it's dialogue. They say, hey, Jones, what's a Kafka? She says, I don't know what a Kafka is. I'll find out. Look in the book. Order all the Kafkas. Give me 20 Kafkas, short stories, novels, everything. And so for the next month, that's what we would do. We would find out what a Kafka was. You know, we would read all of his stuff, and we would discuss it. Because that's where you get it, because the discussion, the dialogue, is what's important. So anyway, I'll go on and on and on. If you have questions, it's best you ask them, you know, before I go off into this. Yes, you have to talk loud, because I can't hear.
Okay. Is there anyone, individual or group, who are doing the kinds of writing that you guys did and we did in the 1960s, Are You, Black Nationalism, and all that kind of stuff?
Well, you have to remember the times change. You know, artists reflect their times. When I got out of the service, Rosa Parks had just sat down in the bus. Emmett Till had just got murdered. You understand? You cannot be in the world, unless you're thoroughly academic, without absorbing what's going on in the world. So all of us were there, talking about the late 50s, Fidel Castro, 1959, March, you know, the kids down in Greensboro sitting in, and the drugs, all that was happening, you know. And we were absorbing that. You know, New York, 1957, you know, I had just got out of the Air Force, you know. Not only had I got kicked out of college, but then I got kicked out of the Air Force. I don't know. It was perfect, absolutely perfect. But that, there are young people all over the world writing, you know. And I don't know if there's a thing that would hook them up the way we were hooked up. We were hooked up in the 50s first against academic poetry. That was the first thing. I mean, whether it was the so-called Beats, the New York School or Harrington, or the San Francisco, Gary Snyder, and Boylan, people like that. You know, Black Mountain. You know, we were organized loosely against academic poetry. Why? Because we hated it, and they hated us. You know, you had to write some kind of Latin or Greek phrase before you wrote about it. I remember I was in Puerto Rico in San Juan. You know, I would go to San Juan, you know, every couple of weeks, disguised as a human being to walk around, you know. And so I got a New Yorker magazine. I was reading this New Yorker magazine. And it was a long poem in there by the editor. And I looked at that, it was like about riding back on the 540 or something like that, up into New York State, you know, and about drinking martinis and bird baths and his wife's adultery and all those kind of things. So, well, I'm not even interested in that. That's like corny to me, you know what I mean? And so then I had to make a decision then that I would try to write what I could write. It wouldn't have the Greek quotes or the Latin quotes. It wouldn't be about bird baths in Connecticut, but it would be about the stuff that I knew about. And that's a decision you have to make. You have to write about what you know about, what you feel. No matter how bizarre it might seem when you first write it down on the page, it might seem weird. Nobody understands. What is that shit? But you also have to be arrogant enough to say, that's my poem. That's what that is. That's my poem. And you know, so then, after the whole the so-called beat stuff, resisting academic poetry, learning poetry, because I learned from some great poets that existed there. Then the whole civil rights movement intensified, you know, by 1960, Malcolm X appeared, 1959, Fidel Castro made a revolution. SNCC started in 1960. And so my mind became more and more interested in social revolution. How do you turn this situation? How do you turn this country around? How do you? And so the poetry begins to show that. Also, interestingly, that I started writing plays because I read in this guy named George Brown, you ever read that book, Englishman, about theater is written, great theater is written, period of revolution. You know, and so you might not wonder why Shakespeare is so heavy, but that was a revolution going on, the end of feudalism, you know, the beginnings of what would be capitalism. That's what he's talking about throughout all of Shakespeare's work. He's talking about the end of feudalism. All them kings and queens and princes and shit is getting iced. A new era is coming into being, you see, so that's why. Plus, Shakespeare didn't have a dictionary. So he wasn't limited. The dictionary comes way after him. You know what I mean? So it's that combination that's what just open. So the more and more the civil rights movement intensified, the more and more I got deeply involved. I found myself going to Harlem at least once a week. I lived down in the village. But I found myself going to Harlem, being involved in those rallies and stuff. I went to Cuba. I met Fidel Castro and Che Guevara. That moved me to see people my age, you know, 20-year-old dudes, 30-year-old women packing pistols who had taken over their space, taken over their country. That moved me. You know, I met Rob Williams down there. And so then we begin to think, well, we began to think that what we write should be more relevant. And being black, we start thinking that if you're going to write, you should write something to help liberate black people, whatever your poetry is. And then on February 21st, 1965, I was at a book party down in the village, and a guy came around me and said, Malcolm X has been murdered. And so the few blacks in there, myself, and we looked at each other like, what are we doing now? Why are we down here? What is the point of this? And that's why I left for Harlem the next month. So it's your life. It's your life that makes you make decisions. You see, if you're true to your life, if you're true to what actually moves you and affects you, you'll make those decisions. It might be hard. If you can find any of my friends in that era from Greenwich Village, they will tell you that he said, fuck you, I'm going. Why? Because that's what was on your mind. That's what affected you. You know, that's what you most wanted to be associated with. You understand? I thought when they killed Malcolm X, they were declaring war on black people. They'd already killed Kennedy. And they killed Malcolm. You know what I'm saying? Then they killed King, then they killed Kennedy. Remember, the four greatest people in that period, political, they killed all of them. You know what I mean? So our generation, we had already split from King, because remember Dr. King, when they finally accomplished that boycott, remember they wanted black people sitting in the back of the bus. People wouldn't ride in the bus from 1955 or 56 to 1958. Then when they accomplished that, they blew up his house. People showed up, Dr. King, what shall we do? What shall we do? You know, the black folks with the rifles. And Dr. King said, if any blood be shed, let it be ours. Now, my generation, as young as you all now, we said, no, we're not going to do that. Now, we love you, Dr. King, but if anybody's going to be bleeding, it's going to be all around bleeding. It's not going to be one-sided bleeding. And that divided the movement into two aspects, the Dr. King and the Malcolm X. And so a lot of the young people followed Malcolm. That's why we went to Harlem. And that's why you had a group of us called the Black Arts Movement who were writing in 1965. Because we went up to Harlem. I was making some money with a play called Dutchman down, and I used that money to rent a brownstone in Harlem. We got a grant, the first one of those HARU grants, and we used it to put four trucks in the street every night. One would have theater, one would have poetry, one would have music, and one would have graphic arts. And that was the Black Arts Movement. What were we doing that for? Because we thought if we were writers, if we were painters, if we were musicians, then that art should have some relationship to the struggle. You know. And that's what that was. That was actually a movement. And I'm sure there are young people around the world who want to do something together to change the nature of this. I wish they would come on and do it, because it's time. You know, you got to fight against the right. Other questions, or you want me to go? Just go on. I will. Yes.
I'm in a hip hop class here.
Yeah, I can't hear you. You have to talk loud.
I'm in a hip hop class here, and we just wrote an essay.
You're gonna have to tell me what she's saying. I can't hear. Okay.
I'm in a hip hop class here, and we just read an essay that said hip hop and the hip hop movement, if that's what you want to call it, is predicated on primarily the Black Arts Movement and Black Power Movement. And that's a pretty bold statement, considering you were the leader of that. So I was wondering, what's your feeling on like the hip hop generation and how they can follow?
Well, that's true to a certain extent, in the sense that we wanted our poetry read aloud. That's why we were in the streets. We were reading poetry to masses of people, you know. And academic poetry is mostly on the page. But our feeling was that if you see a Duke Ellington score, for instance, you can sit there and say, you know, it's hip, if you could read music. But how much better to have that orchestra? Bow, 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 bow. And that's what we feel. The poem exists as a projection of the poet. You see. And just to have it on the page is just to have it on the page. And that's and poetry read moves people. You see. Moves people. Spoken word moves people. You know. People balderize that, mess it up. You know, I mean, one of the problems with the whole, movement is that people try to, slam them. The whole problem with that is too many people then cater what they say to what they expect the audience to. You know, and that ain't happening. You should be trying to teach them, you know. The job of the poet, the job of the artist is to raise people's consciousness, not to descend where they are. Unless they're hipper than you, then you can learn from them. But the point is, you should be trying to raise their consciousness. That's the point. That's the point. And that's what we were trying to do, raise the people's consciousness. like people would tell us, Sun Ra is too far out for the people, you know, Sun Ra is too far out. If you look at this book of mine, this new book of mine called Digging, which is at the front of the Black Arts Theater, there's Sun Ra on the top steps. That's me coming back with the refreshments. But we were getting ready to go out into the neighborhood on a truck. And the people didn't think Sun Ra was so far off. They started dancing. And nobody had told them, that's too far out. You know, no, that, all they heard was the music, not the critics' analysis of it. You know. And so, and it's interesting how art changes. Now, one thing, art in little theater, or even here, this is one thing. But in the street, it's a wholly different thing. My play Dutchman, which won awards, blah, 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 even though people said he's nuts, he won awards. When I took it to Harlem, it became racist. Wait a minute, how did it get racist? You know, 100 blocks later, it turns to be racist. It's the effect that art has on people in the real world, not just an academic thing where it's just in a book. And that's always difficult. The great writer, African writer, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o from Kenya, and you should read his work, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. He went into exile because they told him that if he was going to do plays, he could only do them in English. Now, this is in Kenya. He couldn't do them in Swahili or Gikuyu. Why? Because the people speak Swahili and Gikuyu. And if you do a play that touches their lives in a way that says these people are bothering you, these people are oppressing you, these people in this community are... If you say it in English, it's cool, because the people in English in Kenya, they all got good jobs in the first place because they speak the language of the colonial. But to speak the language of the people, that's another thing, you see. So you always got to learn how to do that, too. You got to try to speak the language of the people. The mass language, you got to raise their level of consciousness. Raise their level of consciousness, you know. And you need to do it, man, because this America, boy, is embarrassing, you know what I mean? It's extraordinary. I mean, this whole thing about healthcare, I mean, it's extraordinary. That somebody could tell you, we could help you and give you healthcare, and you say, no, don't do it. Mad people, yes?
What is consciousness?
Excuse me? Well, it comes from the word I know, Latin comes from with knowing, con, with skill, to know. And it's helping people to know about whatever it is you need to know about. You know, what these people need to know about is this place they are in and why it's like it is. You know what I mean? That's what they need to know. You understand? Look, if people in this country, or any country, were educated, see, if we were all educated, if you had to have a PhD to come out of the house, see, it'd be different. It'd be different. Because the stuff they say, then you would be like over your head. What? What do you tell you? What do you mean by that? You know, but they like that. They tell you, blah, 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 blah. Most people, I mean, how could this stuff on television be on television like that if you had any kind of education? I mean, it couldn't be. You know, but that's why education is not a priority. Education for the few is a priority. You know. I mean, if you get a job teaching, for instance, you're almost taking a vow of poverty like a poet. Unless you're teaching in the little places. You know, I taught at Yale for a while. I taught at Yale for a year. I could see what that is, what they do. You know, that's a whole... Then I taught at State University of New York for 19 years, they're not even related. See, I don't want to talk bad about your school, but I'm telling you, state education and the elite education are not related. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, you know, you go to a state school, you know, you get what you can get out of it, you know. But you have to do a lot of that yourself. You have to become interested in something and find out what that is. Because if you find out enough about one thing, you'll know a lot about a lot of things. You know, if you study one thing carefully enough, you'll find out, because they're parallels, analogies. Excuse me, you had your hand up? Somebody back there?
I'm okay, sir. Continue. You answered my question.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Mary, it's African American History Month, and I wondered if I could comment on the lives and careers of three African Americans: Percy Sutton, Michael Jackson, and Denver University graduate Condoleezza Rice.
Oh, shit. Hey, I'd like to introduce two important friends of mine, writers, Joe Ritchie, who's a very, and Eleni Sikelianos, who's a very fine poet, you know. Now, you mentioned Percy Sutton. Percy Sutton was a great man, first of all, you know. Percy was a grassroots millionaire, if you can understand that. He had come up from the roots, you know. And Percy's the only guy I know with $1 million who could show up at a conference with a Mao cap on. You know, that kind of person. He was the person, he's the one who put Jesse Jackson to run for president of the United States. That came from Percy Sutton. If you go back and read the history of the 1972 Gary Convention, you know, where there were 8,000 black people that we brought to Gary, Indiana. Richard Hatcher was the mayor. Charles Diggs, who was the chair, the congressman who was chair of the Africa Committee, Congressional Committee on Africa, and myself pulled that together. It was Percy who was generated a lot of money out of New York, generated a lot of consciousness out of New York. And so he then, through his own efforts, he was also one of those Tuskegee Airmen, you know. And I heard a guy who was in that with him say, well, Percy, he didn't do no flying. He was in charge of intelligence. And he would lay out the intelligence before they flew. And he came back and say, Percy, you know, you didn't tell us there would be guns over here and guns over there and guns over here. He said, well, I couldn't see everything, but you But he was a very important person in that period, very important to the whole movement for black electoral politics. Remember, he was the borough president of Manhattan. He was a candidate for mayor. But he never lost his directness, you know. He was a very, very fine person. Now, the people that hang on with him, Dinkins, you know, was the mayor of New York, that comes from Percy. Charlie Rangel, the congressman, that comes from Percy. All those people. Basil Patterson's son, who's now the governor of New York, that's Percy Sutton. So if you want to study a great Afro-American businessman, and was it Inner City Broadcasting, WBLS, you know, the Apollo Theater, he bought the Apollo Theater, fixed it up when it was closed, you know. It's a great man. I remember when he was getting Dinkins to run for mayor, you know, and I was talking to them, Dinkins and Percy and Rangel, and I said, you want me to come over and help you out? He said, oh, no. But smart guy, very smart guy. I miss him. The other two you said was who?
Michael Jackson and Condoleezza.
Who was the second one?
Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson was a great artist. What can I say? He had problems. You know, he had problems. I went to see Michael Jackson. I went to see the Jackson 5 in their hotel. I was writing a story on the Jackson 5. And they were staying in this little hip hotel. Was it Park Avenue? I think it was Park Avenue. And Joe had them sitting on a couch in front of the television set. Each one had a handful of gum. That was their preparation for the show at Radio City Music Hall. You know. So I know Mike a long time. He had a lot of problems. I mean, he had problems physically. You know, I mean, all of that wasn't self-hatred. Some of it was physical deterioration. But he also had some other problems psychologically. I mean, the whole thing about him being a pedophile, I don't believe that. But I believe it's strange if you want little children to sleep in your bed. You know what I'm saying? I mean, even you could be absolutely cool, whatever you're doing, but to have tell you want kids sleeping in your bed, that's a bizarre idea. You know, that's all I can say about that. But he was a great, certainly one of the greatest performers of that period. He's affected, I mean, you can't see any of those, you know, those music videos without seeing people doing the dancing that he introduced with Beat It and, you know, Thriller and all that stuff. I mean, all that choreography and stuff, you know. And some of his stuff was very positive. Not only We Are the World, but some of the stuff like, They Don't Care About Us and stuff like that. I mean, he had some positive ideas. But also he was caught up in the whole Hollywood thing. Hollywood is Hollywood, you know. The last person you talk about, Condoleezza Rice, well, Condoleezza actually was raised by that milieu she was in. Her father condemned Martin Luther King when she lived in Birmingham. If you know where the little girls in Birmingham were blown up, she went to that same church. Her father condemned Martin Luther King as a troublemaker. Then, you understand what I'm saying? I met her when she was the provost of Stanford University in her 30s. You know, so you're talking about somebody who's been, you know, twisted in that way for a long time. You know, one of her quotes, they ask her, "Miss Rice, when you were in, you say, what were your?" She said, "What did you think about the civil rights movement?" She says, "Well, when the civil rights movement happened, I was in college, and I was studying the piano." And she said, "I really didn't pay much attention to the counterculture." The counterculture. Now, I've been called a lot of bad words, but never counterculture. That's really bizarre, you know. But I mean, to show you where the mind is, you know. But that Stanford is very good for that, for creating that kind of mind. There was another black faculty member who said, "I was with the civil rights movement until they tried to do what? Until they tried to disrupt the country. And then I had to speak out," she said. She said, "The founding fathers told us what to do." Now, I had never heard a black person say founding fathers in my life. That was a revelation. You know? Founding fathers. I thought that was Jesus in there. But apparently there have been people raised like that post my generation, you know, people who did not have to face that direct evil of racism and poverty and stuff like that. Very, very difficult. And I think this generation you're going to see more people like that, many more people like that, black people I'm talking about, and white folks who don't know anything about, have no idea from whence this country comes. But Condoleezza was a trip, you know, I could say that. She was a real trip, you know. I even wrote bad poems about her, you know. I mean, give me a break, Jesus Christ. And then for her to be traveling around with W, you know, my husband, oh, Jesus Christ. Yes.
Do you think it's the indication of the preponderance of black people to go into professions, law, medicine? Do you think that's the means of buffering themselves from the reality? Does it work?
I think that going to professions is a means of doing that?
Of buffering, of protecting yourself from something.
Well, it is, obviously, but that doesn't mean you have to be insensitive to what's happening. Now, I'd say this: whatever way you can make a living and get through the world in this place, do that. But don't go crazy. You know, because a lot of people, once they achieve something, that's the end of their lives. You know, and a lot of y'all will get those kind of jobs in those institutions that are aimed at destroying people's lives. But you just have to remember reality. You have to remember reality. You have to work at and study what's happening in the world, not get so far removed from actually what's happening in the world. You know, it's difficult. Mao said, where do ideas come from? From social practice. What you do creates what you think. So you have to make sure that what you do doesn't interfere altogether with reality as it is. It's very easy that if you had one of these good gigs, so forth and so on, and not have to face those kinds of things, the poverty and the racism and the injustice, to think that it's not there. And that those people who suffer from that did it to themselves.
Take
what view?
The view that it's not their problem. The view that what's best for GM is best for them, too.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
What's best for GM is best for them. In other words, what's best for them. The majority is best for them. In other words, giving in to get along.
Well,
could you repeat the question?
I think he said.
Is it dangerous? Isn't that dangerous?
Why do you think black people take that position of taking the reflecting the ideas of the majority of people?
Right.
Yeah. Because they're surrounded by the majority of people. I mean, that's the problem. That's the problem. That's why we kept talking about self-determination. Self-determination. You must determine what you need. You cannot let other people determine what you need. You see. So that, look, for instance, jazz, Afro-American music. Today, where can you play? That's the question. Not only have people learned your stuff, but now they've created venues and tours from which you are excluded. Couldn't do that if you create your own stuff. It's difficult. Because if someone says, I'll give you $2 to do this, you take the $2 rather than have to be poor for a longer time to create your own thing. It's the same way with poets and writers. Rather than write your thing, create your own publishing operation. It's easier. That's all it is. It's easier. Much easier. The reason that I started those magazines when I was younger, and still publish a newspaper, which I'll give you a free copy of, is because of my consciousness, the need. You felt the need to do it anyway. Like for every book like this that I, what is this? University of California. You cannot wait for that. You have to do it yourself. You got stuff you want to say between this and then? Do it yourself. If you're a painter, open your garage. You got a basement? Do some music down in your basement. Do not wait. Don't be constipated by commerce. I guess that's what it is, I will give you a free newspaper. This newspaper, Joe, this is the same as we put this out the eve of the inauguration. And it's the same message. We get ready to come out with another one next month. President Obama, no bailout. Nationalize the banks and the auto industry. Same message. They gave those people the bailout. They bail out the banks. What did they do? They went away with it. They're not giving out any loans. That's why those people in Chicago took over that plant, those Latino workers in there. Because they went to Bank of America. Bank of America wouldn't give them a loan to pay the workers, so the workers took over the factory. The banks will not become charitable organizations. And if you think they will, they will not. This guy, Full, who ran, Lehman Brothers. I saw him on television, this congressman. I said, Mr. Full, I understand that you, once Lehman Brothers collapsed, that you got away with $134 million personally. He said, no, Congressman, it's not true. It was only $34 million. You got 6,000 people a day being foreclosed? And you're going to tell me you got away for $35 million? Why? Because you're management? You couldn't manage. The thing collapsed. How can I give you money for management when you didn't? You couldn't manage it. Same thing with General Motors. Why should I give you money? You can't manage. The thing collapsed. So what are we paying you money so you can stay rich? And we can stay dependent and poor. That's what I mean. That was a bad mistake from the beginning. Idealism. You cannot give those people money. Better you take it over. But he said, well, they'll accuse me of being socialist. Well, I mean, there's a lot of things worse than being a socialist. Like Neruda said, the only thing worse than sticking up a bank is owning one. Other questions? You know, I run my mouth on. Yes.
What's your definition of bullshit?
What is it?
What's your definition of bullshit?
Well, any shit larger than rabbit shit. No, just things that don't concur with reality. People tell you stuff that has nothing to do with reality, you know, and mostly that's what governance in the United States is, you know, from this level. Like the Supreme Court just passed this law saying now the corporations can give unlimited. What does that do to democracy? You say democracy. You mean the more money you got, the more democracy you get. So if somebody tells you it's democracy, say, wait a minute, that's bullshit. How can it be democracy and these guys can buy? For instance, in my little town of Newark, New Jersey, population 300,000, 60% black, 30% Latino, you understand? A guy comes in and people give him $6.5 million and he becomes the mayor. Did we vote for him? Yeah, we voted for him. Not personally, but we voted for him. Why? Because if you got $6.5 million, you can buy a lot of votes. You can bullshit people enough. I mean, this man had an advertisement on the Academy Awards to run for mayor of Newark. I knew it was over then, man. I look up at the Academy Awards and said, what? Mayor of Newark, Cory Booker. What? On the Academy Awards? That's not local politics anymore. See, that's national politics. Where did you get that money? $6.5 million. In New York, Bloomberg simply went in his pocket. I forgot how much it was. Joe, how much it was? How much?
11? Maybe, I don't know.
No, more than that. It was more. But anyway, if you're going to make money the determinant of people's choices, then it's not democracy anymore. It cannot be democracy. It never was, as far as I'm concerned. But it certainly can't be now. You know, and if you tell me this, I have to say, that's bullshit. You know. So, other questions. Yes?
You raised the name Cory Booker. What's your relationship with him these days?
My relationship to Cory Booker?
Yes.
A dissatisfied citizen. I told Cory that before. He didn't like me, but I told him that before he even got in the office, you know. It's just Stanford University, another Stanford University person. Yale Law School, a Rhodes Scholar, was then sent to Newark to help us. He said he came to help us, you know. But I remember what the Godfather said when a guy tells him, you know, he said, what did I do to deserve such generosity? That's what I want to know. What did I do to deserve such generosity? You came to help me. No, Cory, he raised our taxes 8% the first week he got in office. He got rid of the top black police officials. The top 10 of police officials now are non-black in a town, 60% black. He brought in all these hired guns, one for the housing authority, who said publicly he refused to live in Newark. You know, the superintendent of schools came from Washington, lived in New York until about a month ago. He moved to Newark. He wants to sell our water, you know, 36,000 acres of land where our water base is. He wants to sell that to an unnamed water authority, which I suspect are people who paid for his election. So it's like that. Just like that. Enough. I mean, my son Raz is running for council this year. He was a deputy mayor. My son Raz was deputy mayor for 4 years at no salary. Now they're paying him $176,000 a year. Well, there's a lot of other people who could use that $176,000 a year. If you're going to have five dudes making $176,000 a year as deputy mayors, you know. So it's like that. It's we feel that we're an occupied Newark. So there's some people who are getting ready to make some political, you know, our election is in May. You know, if you've got nothing else to do, you can come out there and help them out.
A follow-up question.
Excuse me?
A follow-up question.
I can't hear you.
Okay. I have a follow-up question. I just asked you the one about Cory Booker. How about Sharp Change? What's your opinion of Sharp?
Well, let me see. I helped put Sharp James in office. Well, you know that. I put Sharp James in office. I helped put him in office. Sharp James is in jail.
Yes, I know.
27 months. But Sharp actually is different. All that stuff that Cory Booker is claiming, Sharp did. He built the houses. He put in the New Jersey Performing Arts Center. He did the Nets Arena. All that stuff, not Nets Arena, Devils Arena. Sharp James did that. He was fast-talking. Well, his name, his mama knew he wasn't Sharp. That's what he was. He was Sharp. But he was the most popular mayor that has ever been in Newark. I mean, we fought all the time. Nobody ever talked as bad about Sharp James as I did. Because we wanted more than he was doing. But he was doing a lot. You know, it's very hard. But the reason he's in jail is this. The guy who's governor now, that's how he got to be governor, Christie. You know, a 300-pound guy who I said he shouldn't ask for any kind of budget cuts until he at least gets down to 200 pounds. But Christie, along with a group who wanted Sharp, after Sharp got out, accused him of giving land away to his girlfriend. A lot of us with our eyebrows raised and said, girlfriend, because we never thought Sharp had that much interest in girls, period. But they said he gave this land to his girlfriend. But you cannot give land away in Newark because it has to go through the city council. So the whole city council voted to give this land to this woman. But in the middle of this trial, the woman comes and says publicly that her ass is worth this land, whereas he really is put in jail for adultery. And so he was sentenced to 27 months, and he should be out, I guess, in a month or so. But Sharp is still the most popular mayor, you know, for all the problems I have with him over the years. You know, the kind of guy that you have a dance, he comes and starts dancing with the women and talking bullshit to all the people. That's the kind of mayor he was for 16 years. He was the mayor. Yeah.
Do you think it's the best thing that's been written in the last 10 years?
Say that again.
What do you think is the best thing that's been written in the last 10 years?
What do I think of in the last 10 years? What?
The best thing that's been written? The best thing that's been written?
Oh, I couldn't say. There's no such thing. No, there's no such thing because there are thousands of people writing. Depends on what you had to stumble into. What you stumbled into is, I'd say, well, I just read it, you know. I'll tell you one book's more, one of the most important books written in the last 10 years is the book written by Eduardo Galeano called The Open Veins of Latin America. If you saw when Obama was in Trinidad, the book that Chavez gave him, you know, and Tom, read this. That book you should read. That's an important book. The Open Veins of Latin America, Eduardo Galeano. And Galeano is an important writer, you know. But the censorship, you think you know everything, but there's all kinds of books published all over the world you don't know anything about at all. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about U.S. imperialism post-9/11?
I can't hear you. What did you say?
Talk about U.S. imperialism and post-9/11.
Oh, U.S. imperialism.
Just a small topic.
Well, it's still imperialism, you know. I mean, see, first of all, you've got to go back to where it all came from, which is a long time. But the question of 9/11, which I never went for, which is why I got busted from the poet laureate of New Jersey, because I never believed that. You know, I never believed that. You know, from the first day that happened. You cannot fly over America. You think you can? Try it. You cannot fly over the United States. You fly over the United States, they'll shoot you down. It'll take them maybe 2 minutes to drive you out of the... So you can... Now tell me, not only can't you fly over America, you definitely can't fly once you say your destination is Los Angeles, and then you make a turn and fly over the most heavily guarded area in the world. You're going to fly where? To Wall Street. And then you're going to fly where? To the Pentagon. And nobody even going to say, hey, what's happening up there? You get lost? No. I was in the Air Force until I got kicked out. They will tell you immediately, your course is 0785. You've deviated from that course. Why? Don't answer and see what happens. You cannot do it. So first of all, that was jive. I said, no, that's jive. That didn't happen like that. The second thing is this. When they found the passport in front of the World Trade Center, the terrorist passport in front of the World Trade Center, I said, my God, I mean, that's too corny. Even Americans wouldn't believe that. Would Americans believe that? Yes. Then when Cindy McKinney got into trouble talking about United Airlines and American Airlines a month before 9/11, that people were put stock on that, taking that stock out. How is that? Is that a coincidence? You know. So it was, you know, it was to me just fantasy. Now the whole question about anti-Semitism, which they want to put on me, that's the easy way to get out of it. Answer those questions. Answer those questions. That's what you need to answer. How can you... I don't know. Anyway, the questions that remain to be answered in that have still not been answered. Rice and Bush obviously knew the real deal. Did they allow that to happen? Which is probably what happened, that they knew. How is it they got all the pictures of the so-called terrorists in the newspaper the next day when some of them never even was there? Who never left Pakistan or Saudi? How come all of them were supposed to be Saudi and their best friends are Saudis? Why attack Afghanistan and Iraq if the terrorists come from Saudi Arabia? You want to know about weapons of mass destruction? You got the receipts. You gave it to them. Rumsfeld gave the Iraqis the so-called weapons of mass destruction to use against Iran in that war. You know. So, you see, the problem with knowing stuff or doing study of stuff is that then that puts you at odds with most people who don't study shit. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you study anything thoroughly enough, you will learn things that will put you at odds with most of the people in the world. And it'd be difficult for you even to discuss it with them. That's not the way I heard it. And I tell you. You know. And so then a dude's going to say, you're anti-Semite. So wait a minute. The story about five Israelis on the roof of a truck filming it came out in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Star Ledger twice. You mean because I repeated that? See, that's just bullshit. That's a defense mechanism. England, France, Israel, Russia, and China knew, had sent them warnings about this attack. Why didn't you do something about it? What was a plane flying around pretending to be a plane that would crash into the World Trade Center? What was that? Who was in charge of that plane? What was the point of that? Why were they doing that? Pretending somebody wanted to attack the World Trade Center. Why would you do that just hours before they actually attacked the World Trade Center? But if you, again, like I say, study it. There's a videotape called In Plain Sight you can look at that shows you all these things. In fact, it'll show you the Pentagon where the thing crashed. There was nobody in there. They were repairing it. That's convenient. Crash into place, nobody. Where were the bodies? The bodies were burned up. The bodies were burned up. All the bodies that were in the Pentagon were burned up. How was that possible? There's also a book called the second Pearl Harbor or the new Pearl Harbor. You should look at that one. There's a lot of literature out there. You should read it and make your own judgment. But my judgment was very swift based on the facts that I had gotten. I said, the fact that I put it in a poem, see, that's the terrible thing. You could be the poet laureate, but no truth. You can talk about birds and bees and shit like that, but don't talk about what's happening in the world. You know what I mean? Out of the 1,000 writers or the 100 writers in the Encyclopedia Britannica, there was only one woman who, this woman, I can't think of her name, she's a Catholic writer. No blacks, no colored people at all. Now they said, they mentioned Du Bois, but they had to disqualify him because he continued to talk about the world, which is a terrible thing. If you want to be a great writer, you can't talk about actual stuff. Other questions before I disappear? Yes?
And Mary, when you look at your early, there's such a shift in your early work to your later work. What do you see when you look at your early work? The Dead Lecture, Preface to a 20-volume Suicide Note, and that early
work? Well, I see, when I look at my early work, I see an early me, you know, somebody who's trying to find out about the world. See, that's one thing I learned. If you are young, and or not even young, if you're just a writer who, I don't know this, I don't know that, it's like Sartre said, if you say, this happened, but I don't know what it is, that's art. But if you say, this happened, and I know what it is, then that's social protest. So the question is, at a certain point, you either have to be able to say what you think, or you have to bail out of it, you know, or say it in ways, you know. I mean, I had literature where I said stuff where I'm talking around stuff. You know what I mean? You use the image, but you say all the things that come to your mind when you see that image, rather than say what it actually is. Because censorship still exists in the United States. I don't know if you all know that. I mean, censorship exists in the United States. Classes exist in the United States. You know what I mean? Like I said, when I taught at Yale, I didn't know people went to school like that. I mean, I didn't know you actually, that there were people you could actually be in a university and, you know. The guy, when I taught my class, there was a guy in there, a freshman. He had been writing for literary magazines before he got in to the university. He brought me a copy of a magazine that he had printed. Not he had printed, but he had, and this is a freshman, you know. The one afternoon, we had two Nobel laureates, Willie Soyinka, and what's the brother from the islands? Derek Walcott, and Willie Soyinka, and myself, half this many Yale students. Half this many, maybe a third. They fit in the downstairs of a dormitory. Two Nobel Prize winners. That year I taught at Yale, I slept in the same bed with Alice Walker and Toni Morrison, not at the same time. I hasten to say that. But you mean to tell me Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and Willie Soyinka and Derek Walcott and Amity Baraka are all in Yale this one year? That's extraordinary. That's extraordinary to me. John Cage comes in the evenings, and then the president of the American Baseball League comes in to speak. You know, education is what you're exposed to. You see, what you're exposed to, that's what's education. So why do they educate those people like that? Because they are supposed to run this shit, not you. You understand what I'm saying? They're supposed to run it. You're just supposed to be in it. Now, once you learn that, then you take a hard line on what's happening, you know, in the world. You know. Other questions?
Maybe just like one more question.
Yeah.
We'll wrap up.
Uno más. Don't see it.
Well, we were talking earlier in the car ride about, and I think you've kind of been hitting on this a lot of points, but just the idea of being able to step outside of yourself as a means of seeing things. and kind of poetry as a way of raising consciousness. But I'm wondering, and maybe you answered it when you answered Eleni's question, if when you go into writing, if there's a reflective raising of consciousness that happens through the act for you, or if you go in to tell everyone else.
If you go in, what's the last one?
If you go in to tell everyone else, like if you write to tell everyone else,
yeah.
Or if there's still a reflective.
Well, it's not like that, because first you're telling yourself, too. See, the whole act of writing, the whole act of art is discovery, self-discovery. If you're really writing at the top of your shit, a lot of the stuff you say will be the first time you see it. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. I remember I wrote a play called Dutchman. I wrote the play, I came home from a bar, you know, hanging out with great writers. If I named them, you would know them. Great writers and great painters, I came home. And sat down and wrote. Now, I wrote all night, and then I looked at it. What is that? Because actually, I didn't know what I had written. You understand what I'm saying? I didn't actually know what I had written. But I looked at it, you know, a day or so, whenever I got back around to it. So I was like, what is that about? Because I had actually gone past my literal self. See, if you write only what you know, it'll be boring, even to you. No, it's true. If you write only what you know, see, the point is you have to begin with what you know. But you have to always reach out, reach out, reach out, reach out. Never settle for the given. The given is what you're given. You know, never settle for that. You have to always be willing to learn and to be instructed by what you know that you don't know you know. Because a lot of stuff you know, you don't know, you know. You know it's the three levels of knowledge that Mal laid out. One is perception. You know, that's like an antennae. Everything that happens in and around you, you know, you absorb it. You know. The second level, though, is rationalization. You have to then explain to yourself what that perception was. You understand? You see something. So what was that? That's the second level. The third level is use. How do you use that rationalization or that perception? How do you use that? Like I can talk all day and night about the piano, but I can't play the piano. It's the use, finally. What kind of use do you put that to? And so that's the question of the artist. How do you use these endless kinds of perceptions that you have, you know, going through the world, walking up and down the street, talking to people, looking at people, endless perceptions. What is that? What is that that I saw? What is that that I heard? What does it mean? Then how do you use that? You know, so the question of half spontaneous, you know, but based on study. That's what I'd say. Is that
it? We'll call it there.
Okay. And so remember, the reading is tomorrow night at DU, Stern Hall 281?
Yeah, Lindsay, second floor at 7:30.
7:30, yeah.
And it's free.
We'll see you there. Thank you.
Yeah, I've got a copy of this newspaper we put out if you're interested.
Yeah, all right.
Thanks a lot.